All right. Hi. What's up? Oh my God. Look, I'm here. I'm on YouTube. I'm on TikTok. I'm on Spotify tomorrow in the future. I'm on Apple Podcasts in the future. And it's People Pleaser. We're back. We didn't have an episode last week, but we're back. I got my teeth pulled last week. Well, so you know, this is the ongoing saga on this show is my friggin' hatred of of dental hijinks and how much stuff I've had to do with my mouth. But I got it done. We did it. I did it. I got a tooth pulled last year on this side. They finally were putting the post in for the implant on this side. And while they were doing that, they took a tooth out on the other side that I got a root canal on last year. And they told me, oh, the root canal didn't take. Sorry. Root canal didn't work. We got to take that tooth all the way out. But while they were able to do the extraction and put the post in for the implant all at the same time on this one. But it just meant that my mouth was healing last week and I was just not feeling up to doing a podcast. I didn't have any guests lined up or anything like that. I don't have a guest lined up this week, but I just didn't want to do it. So I didn't do it. Okay, but we're back and my mouth is fine. I'm still having a hard time chewing, particularly on the side that got the new tooth pulled. And I have teeth missing on both sides now. And there's like this weird, there's like stitches and it's weird, but it's fine. I made it through it. Anxiety wise, made it through it. Really proud of how I did panic disorder wise with the dental procedure. Really stoked on that. I was nervous that whole morning, of course. I was nervous the whole week leading up to it. I was having a hard time eating and just like really feeling that anticipatory fear. Day of the surgery came and there was like a relief a little bit that morning because I was like, hey, I've been stressed about this for a few weeks now. This whole week leading up to it, I've been like really stressed. And now in just a few short hours, it's all going to be done. There was sort of that's nice. I try to find these moments in my panic disorder, in my experience with fear where I can go like, this is sort of a nice feeling to think like in just a few short hours, you know, win, lose, or draw, whatever happens, even if they totally botch the surgery and they totally fuck it up or like my heart stops because they give me too much propofol or whatever happens, in a few short hours, I'm going to know the outcome and it's all going to be done. And there was sort of a relief in that. But yeah, my dad drove me down to the oral surgeon. And my heart rate was going up and I was trying to control my breathing and trying to like, move one step at a time through the discomfort, through the pain. That's sort of my way of going about this sort of exposure therapy these days. It's just like, you just got to keep moving through it. Just one step at a time, moving through it. And Chelsea asked me if I'm coming home for Christmas. I don't think I am, Chelsea. I was going to, but I don't think I am. I was just there. I think I'm actually staying in LA, but enjoy the holiday. Anyway, moving through the fear one step at a time. I get to the office. My heart rate's really high. I get in there. They need like the payment's not working at the payment that I gave them. I have to give them a different card. I get into the chair. They hook me up to an EKG this time. Last time I did this surgery, there was no taking my vitals or hooking me up to a heart monitor machine or anything like that. This time they took my vitals. They hooked me up with sensors to like an EKG. They were like, they wanted to monitor everything. And they go, oh, your blood pressure is really high. Is it normally this high? And your pulse, your heart rate is really high. And I said, oh, well, yeah, my heart rate's been pretty accelerated for the last hour or so. I'm pretty nervous. And they were like, okay, do you think you can get it to come down? And I said, is it a problem if it's high? And they said, it could be. So I don't like that, but I'm like, well, I'm here, right? I'm in the discomfort. I'm not freaking out. I'm not outside the office crying and like I have been before in the past. I'm in the office. I'm in the chair. So I'm like, okay, last step. I just got to see if I can slow my breathing down, see if I can get my heart rate to come down a little bit so that they can get these drugs in my arm and I can go to sleep and have this surgery done. And I did it, dude. I did it. I focused on it. I tried to meditatively just slow everything down a little bit. I'm like, I'm here. We're at the finish line. I don't feel great. I'm uncomfortable, but it's okay. I'm moments away. In just a few short moments, if I can get my heart rate to come down, they're going to put a little needle in my arm and I'm going to go to sleep. I'm going to wake up and I'm going to have one less tooth. And that's what happened. And it was good. And we did it. And made it through, and this time the procedure all seemed to be a lot more successful. The last time I did it, I got a big old infection, and it was like extreme pain for up to like 3 weeks. This time, it's been a little over a week, and I've had barely any pain at all. It's just sort of annoying more than anything. My mouth just feels like it's got stuff in it, you know, and it's obnoxious, but it doesn't hurt, and it's all good. And I made it through it. We got a lot to talk about on this episode of the show, so let's do it. The first things first is I want to respond, just take a moment to respond to some feedback that I got from the last episode. So the last episode that I did 2 weeks ago was where I talked about why I think you're probably wrong about trans athletes in sports, specifically trans women. Went through all the typical arguments that people normally have that, oh, it's not fair because there are biological advantages that you have to acknowledge. People born with male anatomy or assigned male at birth are going to be, in general, stronger than people born with female anatomy or who are assigned female at birth. Just in general, those are going to be the rules that we're going to all have to agree to play by, and it's not fair for people to have to compete against people who have physical advantages over them. Like, that big argument, we attacked that, we broke that down about why that doesn't hold water and how you can't just uniformly say that, like, someone born with one set of genitalia is always going to be stronger than someone else. And also specifically talking about Leah Thomas and how she came fifth at the NCAA championship. And if that rule were true, she would have taken first and demolished everyone else, but she didn't. And in fact, like, there are several female swimmers who were assigned female at birth who have beaten Leah Thomas in head-to-head competition, and that shouldn't be the case if Leah Thomas is the one who's always supposed to be dominating. We also talked about why the whole fairness argument isn't something that people use when it comes to athletes who are competing against each other who have the same genitalia or who are given the same gender assignment at birth from the hospital, like Muggsy Bogues playing basketball against Shaquille O'Neal. Like, broke that down, went through the whole thing about, like, is the entire point of participating in competitive sports just to win? Is that the entire point? So everyone who doesn't win, there's no purpose in them being there? And it's like, no, of course not. There's a lot more to participating in team sports than just whether or not you win. And there's a lot about just, like, the individual and their experience with being part of something competitive and what that does for them and their drive to show up the way that they need to physically to compete and all these different things. And being recognized, just for a trans person to be recognized as the gender that they are by, like, you're a woman, you're going to play women's sports. Just as a society, our recognizing of that, how important that is. Really went through all of these arguments. You should go listen to that episode if you haven't already. I break it all down, but I got a lot of feedback, as I expected to, because as I said at the beginning of that episode, I imagine there are a lot of people in my audience who follow me on social media, who listen to this podcast, who this is an issue I imagine a lot of people would disagree with me on, that a lot of people would be like, oh, geez, I usually agree with Austin, but I'm not with him on this. And that is what happened. Just so many comments of people saying almost that exact same thing. I usually agree with you on everything, Austin, but on this thing, I think that you're being a little too reductive. You're making it a little too black and white. It's more complicated than that. And I can't tell you how many times over the last 2 weeks I've had a near near identical conversation with different people in comments. Like, and everyone thinks that they're bringing a new conversation to me. And the conversation starts out the same way every single time. People go, I think you're being a little, you're oversimplifying this issue and it's more complex than you think it is. And I go, okay, how am I oversimplifying it? What am I missing here? What complexities am I missing? And people start diving into all of the things that I've already addressed. They start diving into just biological differences between people with different anatomical makeups and how you just can't account for that and how that's just not fair, which is a thing that, like, I already spent a significant amount of time in the short video that I made on social media and in the much longer podcast that I made addressing that. Like, so that already gets me sort of upset when someone goes, I think you're being reductive here. I think you're missing something. And I go, what am I missing? And they jump headlong into a point that I fully address. And maybe they jump into it from an angle that I didn't quite cover in the podcast or something, but I'm like, okay, yeah, you found a different angle that I didn't address, but that's also something we can go into, where they're like, oh, well, just in general, the muscle mass of people who are assigned this at birth versus people who are assigned that at birth in general. And I'm like, okay, yeah, but you're not accounting for the fact that, like, trans athletes, specifically trans women, that's who is the, that's who's most predominantly targeted in this conversation. Typically, to be able to compete, they have to meet all kinds of requirements. They have to show a certain hormonal balance in, you know, and they have to be able to, they almost have to show that they are not going to out-compete. They have to show that they're not going to just dominate and win in order to be allowed to compete, which is a totally different requirement than cisgender women have to show. They would never have a cisgender woman be like, are you going to be too good at this? If you're going to be too good at this, you can't play. If you're going to be too good at this, we have to have you sit down. Trans female athletes, trans women athletes very often have to show that they're like, not going to be too good at it in order to be allowed to compete. So like a lot of these arguments of just like the fairness that it's too unfair. I addressed all that in the podcast and I addressed that in the video. And like there's so much information out there. If that's actually your sticking point, if that's what you're stuck on, I would just encourage you to go be curious about that and to go actually investigate for yourself what goes into, what requirements are there for trans women who want to compete in sports, in women's sports. Like, go and look into what it actually takes and see if your argument still holds up and still holds water. Just be curious about it. But then, so these conversations that I was having with people, they would do that. They would start in on the topics that I already addressed, but the thing that I kept seeing again and again from men, but I saw this a lot from cisgender women, women who follow me, women who, again, generally agree with me on a lot of things. I saw this over and over and over again, almost word for word, almost like it was a script. And I'm not saying it was, I'm not saying that like they all read something somewhere in some article and they all repeat. I'm saying that this is a common experience, I think, for a lot of these women who were reaching out to me saying, and it was almost word for word this every single time. They would say, look, I grew up wanting to play sports. I grew up thinking that I could compete just as well in any sport as any of the boys could. In pre-puberty, I was better than most of the boys in my school. I was faster than them. I was stronger than them. And I out-competed them. I was better than them at all the sports, at basketball, at kickball. I was faster than them. And something changed after puberty where I started getting out-competed by these boys and it started making me mad. And even still, I was faster than some of my male friends. But then also I was annoyed that like my school started making it so that I had to compete with only girls. They wouldn't let me compete with the boys anymore. And I still wanted to compete with the boys. And the boys sort of lorded it over me that like their sport was more popular than mine and that they were better at their sport than I was at mine. And I always wanted a chance to compete against them, but I couldn't. So there was sort of this like, there's this story that I kept hearing over and over again of people who had personally an axe to grind with just sort of the gender dynamic in sports in general, and that they felt slighted by our patriarchal society. And I think that that feeling of being slighted and feeling of being shortchanged and being looked over and passed over and sort of looked down on is 1000% valid. We absolutely live in a patriarchal society that looks down on women in sports and that looks at them as, you'll never be able to do this as well as a man can do it. And your sport will always be less popular because it's less entertaining because you guys aren't as good at it. And I see that frustration, and I think it's 100% valid. And a lot of these women would tell me, you know what I learned to do is I learned to just say fuck them and embrace the fact that I competed in women's sports and just be as good at women's sports as I possibly could. And I just decided to be the best female athlete I could possibly be. And I went, hell yeah, more power to you. And where this story would always wind up is they would say, so when men get included in my sport, after a lifetime of being looked down on by men and having things stolen from me by men and having men take things that I want and not being allowed access into spaces that I want to compete in because men say I can't, and not only in sports, but in my life being preyed upon by men, made the object of objectification and men's sexual desires and the male gaze and sexual assault and all of the stuff that goes into that, to now have this space that I was told, this is your space. Women's sports is where you are going to compete. To now allow men, biological men, into my space really bothers me. And this is, and I heard this over and over and over again from person after person. And I talked about this on the podcast too, that like, at the bottom of all of this, when you get through all of people's different arguments, at the bottom of all of this is, Are you able to accept trans women as women or not? Are you able to accept trans women and their identities as valid or not? And that's really, I think, what's at the core of this issue. Because what I hear when someone tells me that their whole life has been this struggle against, like, how shitty men have made them feel and how men have made them feel, which, again, valid. We live in a patriarchal society where men are making women feel less than and second class and weaker. And that is a valid frustration. But if you cannot separate out in your mind cisgender men, predatory cisgender men, misogynistic cisgender men from transgender women, if you cannot delineate between those two, that is the core of the problem. So I had so many people tell me, I think it's reductive of you or rude of you or short-sighted of you to call me transphobic, because I'm not transphobic. I support trans people. I support the cause of trans people, of non-binary people, of queer people. I want them to be respected. I want them to feel respected. I want them to feel seen and validated. But if you tell me that just because I have this sticking point on sports, I'm transphobic, I don't agree with that. And I think that you're being reductive or short-sighted or kind of rude to me. And look, I get it. I get it. It doesn't feel good to be called potentially bigoted, to be told that, like, beliefs that you have are problematic or are bigoted. That doesn't feel good. I get it. But not being able to see the difference between cisgender men and transgender women is transphobic. And people get really stuck on phobic too. People really don't like that because they'll go, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid of gay people. I'm not afraid of non-binary people. I'm not afraid of transgender people. I don't have a fear. I don't have a phobia of people. But you do. What you actually have is a phobia of men, of predatory men, of men who have invaded your space your entire life, of men who have preyed upon you sexually, of men who have stolen credit for your good ideas, of men who have made you feel less than, second class. And you have a valid fear of those men. But your inability to grant trans women the space to say, I don't see you as that. I recognize you as a woman who was assigned male at birth, who was born with male genitalia and some male anatomy, maybe not even all, but like enough male anatomy that that's the gender assignment they gave you. But I recognize you as a woman who just wants to live authentically as a woman. If you cannot do that, if all you see when a transgender woman comes into the bathroom that you're in and you maybe clock them or spot them is a predatory man, that is transphobic. And I'm not saying that to be rude, and I'm not saying that to hurt your feelings or to call you a bad name. I'm saying it to be accurate and specific, that what you have is, even if you don't like the way it feels, like, you have a fear of these people coming into your space, because what you see when these people come into a space that has been designated for you is an invader. You see someone who does not belong there coming in to take something from you. And I just kept seeing this over and over and over again. People would say this line to me over and over again. They'd say, I care about trans women and I care about women. And they would say, I don't think you, Austin, care enough about women, the women who are harmed by trans women coming into their space. And I would hear that over and over again. Austin, you don't care about the women who are harmed by these trans women coming into their space and stealing trophies from them and outcompeting them. And I'd be like, hold on, like, you're not hearing yourself there. You're saying in that sentence that women and trans women are not the same thing. And that's TERF shit. And so people would go, call me a TERF, call me a transphobe, whatever you want to call me, whatever bad name you want to call me. I'm not saying that to be rude. I'm not saying that to call you a bad name. You are engaging in rhetoric that separates out women, not even just cisgender women. You see the umbrella of women as not inclusive of trans women. You see trans women as a separate thing. And what you see trans women as, and what is revealed in the rhetoric that you engage in with trying to be exclusive of trans women in sports, is you see trans women as fundamentally, at their core, men who see themselves as women, but who aren't real women, who are invading your space and taking things from you that are rightfully yours, just like all the other cisgender men who have done that to you your entire life. And again, I get where that frustration and that fear comes from, because your anger and your frustration at cisgender men, at predatory men, is valid and is warranted. But misdirecting that anger at trans women is the problem. And I understand that it's not comfortable to be confronted with that. The fact that, like, your valid anger and frustration is spilling over and affecting another marginalized community and harming another marginalized community, and that you're going to have to do some work to be able to parse out cisgender men from transgender women. And you're going to have to be able to work to get to a place where you can start to accept transgender women as belonging in those spaces, as people who belong in those spaces, as people who are also victims of the oppression and tyranny of a patriarchal, misogynistic society. So that's my response to that. I'm sure that there will be some people who still have a hard time hearing that, but that's what I just kept seeing over and over and over again, is people who were telling me I was being reductive, I wasn't seeing the full scope of things, people who were telling me that as a man, as a cisgender man, I couldn't possibly understand the struggle of being a cisgender woman and seeing and being relegated to these spaces that you don't necessarily want to be relegated to, but then seeing men coming in, calling themselves women and taking that from, like, people were like, you couldn't understand. And I'm like, I couldn't fully understand the experience of being a woman. Of course I can't understand that experience. But that doesn't mean that I can't see how it's problematic to conflate transgender women with cisgender men. And I get it. I get why you're conflating the two, but conflating the two is inherently transphobic, because what it does, and I said this on the podcast last week, is it does two things that are incredibly harmful to trans people that I need you to understand. One, it invalidates trans identities. It says that trans identities are not real, that it is just an illusion in the trans person's head. It's not real. That person is still fundamentally a man or a woman who just sees themselves as the other gender, and we are just humoring them and placating them when we choose to go along with whatever name or pronouns they want to call themselves. It invalidates their identities, which is just massively harmful. And the other thing is, it paints them as predators. It paints them as people who are doing that, who are pretending to be something else so that they can gain access to a space that they wouldn't have had access to previously, and they can prey on the people who are supposed to be in that space. And those two things are incredibly harmful. And that's why it's just, I can't go with you on this thing. I know that you don't like being called a TERF or a transphobe. I know that you don't like having your ideas, especially when you're like, on everything else, I'm so progressive. On everything else, I support these people. On everything else, I'm so kind. I just don't want them in my locker room or out, like, beating me in a race, you know? And I get it. I would just encourage you to be more curious about that, to seek out more information, to just ask more questions, maybe not to me. I'm a little bit tired of the conversation right now, frankly, because I've had the same exact conversation so many times over the last couple of weeks with so many different people. And I want this to maybe be the last thing I say on it for a while. I want to have some trans athletes on my show to hear from them, and just maybe that can help in the future. But that's what I'll say about that for now. There's a few other things I want to talk about on the show this week, so I'm going to move on from that. But I just wanted to address the fact that I did get a lot of feedback on that episode, as I expected to, and that I wasn't particularly impressed with any of it. I'm always looking for someone who's going to make the argument that I haven't heard. I'm always looking for someone who's going to come at it from an angle that I go, oh shit, you know what? I hadn't considered that. I hadn't thought of that. But what I kept seeing over and over and over again were things that just further solidified my position and validated my position that, like, fundamentally what's going on here is we are not seeing trans women as women. We are seeing trans women as predatory men who are coming into spaces designated for women to steal things from women. And that's the problem. Fundamentally, at the core of the issue, that's the problem that I think needs to be addressed, because that is the thing that harms the trans community the most is our insistence that they do not belong anywhere and that they are predators with delusional brains. So that's all I'll say on that for now. Moving forward. Okay, there's something I've been wanting to talk about publicly for a while now. I talk a lot on this podcast, especially lately, about politics and sociopolitical issues and things like that. The thing I'm going to talk about right now, it's going to sound initially like I'm just being a nerd and your brain might want to turn off and you might go, oh, I have no interest in this. I don't care about this. But I promise that it is linked to very real stuff happening in our world that is very important for us to think about and to be aware of and to see. And also, I do, you know, from time to time on this podcast, I do just like to talk about stuff that I'm a nerd about. And, you know, I did an episode all about Batman, and I did an episode with my dad all about college football and why I like college football, and we talked about the problematic elements of that sport and stuff like that. I did an episode, you know, back when The Rise of Skywalker came out, I did an episode just about, like, Star Wars and the cultural phenomenon that is Star Wars and what makes people attracted to Star Wars so much. I do like talking about things just in culture that I just find interesting. And I feel like a little bit on this podcast, I've been getting away from that recently. And it's just sort of been like my hot take of the week on whatever is going on social media. And so I'm going to talk today about the show Andor on Disney Plus. And I'm going to be a nerd about it first. I'm going to talk first as a Star Wars fan about why this is the best piece of content ever made in the Star Wars universe. But just hang with me. Hang with me. If you're a person who's like, I don't give a shit about Star Wars, hang with me. And I'm going to bring it around to why I think you should watch this show and why I think everyone should watch this show and what this show says about the world that we currently live in, and about just human nature, and about what gives rise to systems of evil and systems of oppression. Like, how does that happen? How does it keep happening? How is this a cycle we keep finding ourselves in? I want to talk about that. But first, I just want to be a nerd for just a second. As just a lifelong Star Wars fan, as a person who grew up collecting Star Wars memorabilia and toys and waiting in line outside of the theater for every single prequel movie and being disappointed by pretty much all three of them, but going nonetheless, this is the best piece of content, period, hands down, ever created in the Star Wars universe, and it's not particularly close. Just like, you know, the first time I saw Rogue One in theaters, I remember sitting in the, I had no expectation for that movie. I was already, even at that time, I was already like, we're going overboard with how much Star Wars stuff we're producing. It was like Solo, a Star Wars story was coming out. At that time, the Boba Fett series was going to be a movie. They had announced all these different movies, like Boba Fett, and it was just, and then they realized with Disney Plus, we'll turn these into series, and it became even worse, that it was just like this deluge of, you're going to get so much Star Wars content, you're not going to know what to do with it. And this was before Mandalorian, this was before Boba Fett, this was before Obi-Wan. The only things, but it was like, the Disney had purchased Star Wars, and they had announced that they were going to be making all this stuff, and I remember going and seeing Rogue One, and it just felt like, is any of this going to be any good at all, or is it just going to be all too much? And I remember also thinking, like, who the fuck cares about this filler story between the end of the prequels and the beginning of A New Hope? Like, it just seems like this is a story that fit into the text crawl of the first of the first release in 1977. Like, the story that they tell in that text crawl, they decided to make into a whole movie. And I remember thinking, like, not a good idea for a movie. Like, we're capable of filling people in on some of the stuff that happened between movies. We want to make movies about the most important events. I was not ready when I went and saw that movie in theaters, and I did see it in theaters, of course, because I'm a huge Star Wars fan. I wasn't ready to watch the best Star Wars movie. And I remember, like, 45 minutes into the movie thinking, like, well, I think this is the best thing they've ever made. And I thought that pretty early on too. Like, every scene sequentially that would happen, I would just go like, so this is, it just feels different. The cinematography is just head and shoulders above anything they've ever put out. It's just insane what a difference Greg Frazier behind the lens makes. And I've been saying that for a while, that like the way a thing looks impacts the way I feel about it so much in visual storytelling in cinema. Like a big problem I have with a lot of the Disney Plus shows is they look like glorified CW shows or like expensive fan films. Like the cinematography just looks cheap. They shoot a lot of it on the, in this egg studio thing that they have at Disney, where they do these LED screens of different locations, and it just feels, everything feels fake. Everything feel kind of the way that the prequels felt. Like the prequels look like Space Jam. Like the prequels literally are like a real actor in a completely animated environment. The floor is animated, the furniture is animated, the walls are animated, every character is animated except for Liam Neeson and Ewan McGregor, and it looks like Space Jam. And nothing feels real, whereas, you know, the original trilogy had this tactile element of like real practical sets that made you feel like you were immersed in a world. And they had the right cinematography for the type of movies that they were making. It felt like colorful, schlocky, B-movie fare. But when you, in the modern world with the technology we have, it's sort of insulting, and the money that Disney has, it's sort of insulting to watch how bad the cinematography is on some of these shows and some of these properties. And then Rogue One comes out, and Greg Frazier's behind the lens, and it's like, oh, I mean, this can look stunning. This can really look gorgeous, and just looking pretty is the first step. Then you have a script that has dialogue that doesn't feel, I mean, it's almost too good, because it doesn't feel connected to the rest of the cinematic universe, because in the rest of the cinematic universe, people talk in kind of like wink at the camera, tongue-in-cheek one-liners, and everything's, you know, written for comedic effect and stuff. And here you have characters talking who sound like real people, and it's almost jarring to hear. It's like, this doesn't sound like a Star Wars movie. It doesn't look like a Star Wars movie from the color grading and the cinematography, and it doesn't sound like a Star Wars movie. And now you've got, because the dialogue's better, you've got performances that are blowing away anything that's ever come in the series before. And now you've got a story too. On top of it all, you've got a story to tell here, which, again, it was just the text scroll at the beginning of the first movie. But what we're actually telling is the story of the real people, the nuts and bolts people that propped up the circumstances for the big heroes, the Jedis and the Siths, to have their big epic battle. But there were real people behind that rebellion that made that thing happen. And that's what that story is about, is like the real people who make a rebellion possible, who give Luke Skywalker the green light to go in there and save the day, who paved the way for that, the working class of a rebellion. There's no Jedis, there's no grand heroes, there's no overpowered people who could be the ruler of the universe if they wanted to. There's just real people who have lost real things to an imperial regime who are fighting back. And it's crazy how good of a movie it is. And now Andor comes out, and it's based on one of the characters from that movie and his story of how he comes to be a part of this rebellion. And it is the best piece of content that has ever been put out in the Star Wars universe. And again, like I said, it's not particularly close, and it's almost too good. It's almost so good that it makes everything else look bad by comparison, because it's like, well, this doesn't, it's hard to even imagine that the characters from the other movies exist in this same cinematic universe, because they are so cartoonish in comparison to how human and well-developed and well-rounded the characters are in this universe. But I still prefer it. As a fan, I'm still like, well, I don't care. This is what I've always wanted. And as a fan who grew up with this and who grew from a Star Wars kid into a Star Wars adult, I'm so happy that this is where we are, that I finally have something that I can latch into and that I don't need to like apologize for liking, that I don't need to go like, eh, it's supposed to be silly, it's supposed to be stupid. You kind of have to just sort of turn your brain off and have a good time, which is sort of how I went through 7, 8, and 9. I saw 7 in theaters and I genuinely had an amazing time. I genuinely was impressed with how much I liked it. J.J. Abrams brought back a lot of that tactile stuff, a lot of the practical effects. I cried when Kylo Ren stabbed his dad through the stomach. I wasn't expecting to be so emotionally affected by that moment. I thought it was very well pulled off. And in that entire trilogy, Adam Driver is fantastic. Adam Driver is giving like Shakespearean level acting for that entire trilogy. So props to Adam Driver. And they've got a great cast. Like everybody does a good job buying in and selling it. But there is a lot in that trilogy of, there's a lot of turning your brain off and just having a good time. Don't think too hard about it. It's Star Wars. Just have fun. Don't think too hard about like fuel and like how the whole chase and how that works in The Last Jedi, or don't think too hard about just kind of like anything that happens in the third one. Try to just have a good time. You don't have to do that with Rogue One or with Andor. You don't have to apologize for the movie. You don't have to tell people that watch it like, hey, it's kind of corny, but like if you can just turn your brain off and lean into it, there's a lot there. There's a lot of substance there. It's just there. It's just good substantive writing. It's just good characters. It's just great cinematography, great music, great emotional beats, great acting. It's just all there. And you don't need it. It's just good. It's just good cinema. So that's my spiel as a fan. Here's why you should watch that show as a socially conscious person who cares about what's happening currently in our society. I think that there is this tendency to, wherever you live, in whatever time period you live in, to think that totalitarianism, fascism, the rise of an overpowerful dictatorial force could not happen there. You hear that all the time. It can't happen here. It won't happen here. Everyone thinks that. We can see it actively happening in other countries right now. We know that it has been a pattern throughout all of modern civilization. We see that pattern charted in history over and over and over and over again. The rise of dictators, the rise of dictatorial regimes. We see this happening over and over and over again. And we look at it as though it's just sort of this other thing from another time period or from another place that's born out of a different set of circumstances than we have in the place that we live in. And we see it as like, yeah, I know that that is a thing that hypothetically is on the table that maybe could happen, but it won't happen where I live. And you can see it actively happening in other places right now. Right now. Some more news. If you don't watch that show, it's a fantastic show on YouTube. Can't recommend it enough. It's an excellent show. You should get into it. Some More News did a whole episode about what is happening in I can't even think of what the country is right now. Where's Viktor Orban? Where's Viktor Orban at? What country is that? Is it Hungary? Hungary. Budapest? That right? The chat will let me know. But I'll have to let me see. I'm going to look this up really quick just because I'm annoyed that I didn't have that ready to go. Yeah, Hungary. All right, I was right. Okay. Thank God. but they chart basically how Viktor Orban came to power and how Hungary went from being a true democracy to being a dictatorship disguised as a democracy. The people who live there and some of the people in the world still think that Hungary technically is a functioning democracy, and it's not. It has, for all intents and purposes, been taken over by a dictatorial regime hell-bent on securing power at any cost. And it's very obvious. Like, they're not even really pulling their punches anymore over there. Like, Viktor Orban has very strong and popular opposition to his power, but he wins elections by such steep margins that it's like not funny. Like people in America are, you know, like who are election deniers will say it's so unbelievable that 81 million people could have voted for Joe Biden. I'm like, yeah, I get it. I get the sentiment. Like, I think it's crazy that 75 million people voted for Donald Trump a second time. I think that that's crazy. That number is wild to me, but like 75 to 81 isn't that crazy in a country of 350 million people. Like, that's not that wild. It still leaves a whole lot of people who didn't vote and who aren't even registered to vote. Like, those numbers make sense. Viktor Orban is, like, winning on things that he wants to get done by, like, 90% margins and stuff. Like, it's just, like, stupid. It's, like, silly. Like, they're not really hiding the fact that they've just taken over the voting process in their country and the electoral process in their country and just instilled a dictatorship. And it's happened in my lifetime. It's happened in the time that I've been alive. And actively right now, the right wing in my country is cheering on what Viktor Orban has done and is doing, is having him out to speak at conservative political action committees and stuff like that. He's like the keynote speaker at several things. He's come over to America and been a speaker at several huge conservative events. Like, people love Viktor Orban. Steve Bannon constantly talks about what a great guy Viktor Orban is. Trump talks about what a great guy he is. So many prominent politicians on the right are saying, look what Orban has been able to do in Hungary. We should do that. And saying that we should just take over the democratic process the way that they did so that we don't have to deal with fair elections, making it so that we can't stay in power, because they are aware that they have lost popular support in the country. They are aware that they just do not have the majority of people's support anymore in this country, and they are espousing more and more nefarious means of obtaining and securing power long term as that happens. It's happening right before our eyes. It's happening right in front of us, and so many people want to think that it's not as bad as it clearly looks like it is, and that we're still a good ways away from, you know, Germany in the 1940s, or Russia under Stalin, or, you know, Pol Pot or something like that. That we're still, and look, there are certain things that you can point to that I'd say, like, yeah, like the fact that I can live stream on the internet. I mean, who knows? TikTok might kick me off here any moment now. That happens from time to time. But the fact that I can go on the internet, on my podcast, on my channel, and I can speak my mind, and I can speak freely, and I can openly criticize these systems of power means that we are still in a space where we can at least talk openly about it, and we can at least criticize it. And people with bigger audiences than me are still able to talk openly and speak openly about it. And the reason for that is because the authoritarian regimes, or the dictatorial regimes, or the dictatorial would-be forces that want power in our country have not yet seized total power. That's why we're still able to do this and have this discourse and have this feeling of false security. But it doesn't mean that they're not trending in that direction heavily, and that they're not definitely gunning for that kind of control. Like, when these people talk about free speech and wanting free speech on social media, and how they're so excited for Elon Musk bringing back free speech, what they genuinely mean is the opposite. Like, they are on a path to hoping to be able to control the conversation and to control the talking points. They're totally all right with speech being censored. They just don't want their speech to be censored, and they want to be able to say whatever they want to say without being called out for it. But they still like to they still prefer to communicate in dog whistles and code speak, because when someone like Kanye West says everything that they think internally out loud and says it without the dog whistles and without the code speak, they're still sort of forced into a position of being like, oh no, that's bad what he said. Don't say that, Kanye. And they're like, shut the fuck up, man. You're not supposed to say it that explicitly. Dude, like, chill. At least pretend like you're trying to, like, disguise it a little bit. But what they would actually, and that's the thing is, like, so that's going back to Andor. That's the thing, is dictatorial regimes, fascistic regimes, authoritarian regimes, they don't often say out loud, I'm an evil person and here's my evil plan. That's not how it happens. Adolf Hitler didn't get in front of Germany and say, hey guys, I got some real fucked up shit I want to do, and this is how I want to do it. He did, but he used disguised language. He used the language of fascistic cult leaders, where you find a common enemy, an enemy of the national identity, and you villainize that enemy, but you make the villainizing of that enemy rooted in something that feels rational, that this person, these people are threatening our way of life. They're threatening our national security. They're threatening our national identity, our right to our national identity. Trump has gone on stage at rallies and told his followers that the radical left and that people on the left, that this is not their country, but it is ours. That it is not theirs, it is yours. It does not belong to them, it is yours. You have leaders on the left, like Joe Biden and Barack Obama, who will get up and say, hey, I'm not just the president of the Democratic Party. I'm the president of all Americans, and I want to try to be the president of all Americans, even if you disagree with me. I want to rule over, you know, I want to be the president and the representative for all of us. And Donald Trump goes out and openly says, I'm for you guys, not them. It's our country, not theirs. So this is sort of the tactics is you can openly state your agenda, but you still have to couch it in something that feels like it can have a rational or reasonable explanation so that if people look at it and go, hey, that's fascistic rhetoric. That's dictator stuff. He's doing what Hitler did. People can go, well, not explicitly. He's not talking about exterminating anyone or getting rid of anyone. It's like, well, he kind of is. He's saying that half the country doesn't belong here and that this is not their country and that we need to do whatever we can to take it from them and make sure that we get rid of our enemies. So he's not using words like exterminate or wipe from the face of the earth necessarily, but he's more or less saying that. And that's sort of how these things germinate and rise in the early stages. It's not until total power has been secured that the mask starts to slip more and more and more. But we can see it. People who are paying attention, you can see it. You can see the insidiousness behind the rhetoric, the insidiousness behind the code speak, behind the dog whistling. We can see it. And this is sort of what Andor deals with as a show, is it shows like, how does something as obviously evil as the Empire run by Palpatine, which if you've ever seen that guy in any of the movies, he's such an obvious movie villain. The guy, like, he might as well have a neon sign over his head that says bad guy pointing down at him. And this is very much like who Donald Trump is. So many people who pay attention to Donald Trump, it's like, how do you not see that that guy is the obvious clear-cut villain of this story? How do you not see him as the obvious villain that he is? He might as well go around with a neon sign over his head saying, like, cartoon bad guy right here, cartoon mafioso mob man. Like he just looks and sounds and behaves like such an obvious bad guy. How does a guy like that rise to power and manage to convince millions of people? And if you're taking it into the Star Wars context, trillions of people, you know, hundreds of thousands of planets within an entire galaxy, maybe even millions of planets. How do you convince enough people and enough leaders on all of those planets to go along with your empire? And for so long in the Star Wars cinematic universe, the answer seems to, they've never really tried to answer that question. The answer just seems to be like magic evil, like through the magic of the dark side of the Force and the power of persuasion, Emperor Palpatine has single-handedly seduced and let's even say possessed all of the people that participate in the Empire. So everyone that works for the Empire, every foot soldier, every general, every lieutenant, everyone that has a job inside or under the umbrella of the Empire has been seduced and ensnared by the evil cunning of Palpatine. And that, I mean, that doesn't, when you actually think about it, it's like, that's not really compelling. That's not really compelling narrative that it's just people who are evil because an evil guy tricked them into being evil and now they're all evil. And what Rogue One does and what Andor does beautifully is it shows like, no, the people who work for the Empire are people. They're just regular people. Most of them have never met Emperor Palpatine or ever even seen him. Like, they maybe saw him back when he was a senator, but ever since he's become disfigured and he hides away at his palace with his robes, most people don't even, there are probably entire generations born who have never heard him speak. They've heard his name and they've heard him sort of invoked, but for the most part, if they ever see, you know, a show of force from the Empire, it's going to be like a general somewhere on some planet with like a troop of foot soldiers showing up as an occupying force, but they're not actually going to see or hear from the Emperor, and they're not actually going to, not every single person who works for this regime is necessarily taken in by this like evil mindset. You've got too many people for all of them to just simply be evil. And that's sort of, I think, the parallel that we need to see with our own world is like the people who allow fascistic regimes and totalitarian regimes and authoritarian regimes to fester and grow aren't doing it because we have tens of millions of evil people with evil designs. Many of them are doing it because they've been taken in by carefully crafted talking points and rhetoric that seem reasonable enough. So the idea of being for conservatism in modern America, even if you can point to and just go like, you're aligned with like the Ku Klux Klan and with white nationalists and stuff, and you can point to people and go, you're on the same political team as literal Nazis. Isn't that a red flag to you? But they'll shirk that off and go, what I know is I stand for a society that runs on law and order, that we cannot be a society in disarray and in disorder. So when people talk about abolishing the police or even defunding the police or even reforming the police, that terrifies these people. They're like, what are you talking about? We need a society that has law enforcement. We need more laws and stricter law enforcement. So when they hear people on the left talking about like bail reform and saying we should, you know, not have people being held on bail that they can't afford, people who are held in jail for sometimes a year, 2 years, for a crime that they have not been convicted of because they can't afford bail, that's a problem. But all they hear is you're trying to release criminals into the streets. So it's a very like fear-based mindset that also feels like you can rationally defend it. That it's like, I don't want murderers and killers and rapists and you know, sociopaths loose on the streets if I can help it. So many of the characters on Andor who support the Empire and who work for the Empire do so because they see the Empire as the antithesis to disorder. It is order versus disorder. So for the longest time in the Star Wars cinematic universe, it's been this story of light versus dark, the light side versus the dark side of the Force versus the Jedi, the enlightened, you know, minds. And it's been very clear, and you've had really clear-cut good guys and bad guys. What Andor does is it flips it and it says to all of these people who work for these fascistic regimes and who help prop up their cause, what they see is a world that is order versus disorder, you know, order versus chaos, that without the Empire is the only thing that is holding the galaxy together. The Empire is giving stability and security to the galaxy. Yeah, the Empire, like some of the byproducts of the Empire, or let's call it late-stage unfettered capitalism, some of the byproducts of it are that like a lot of people are suffering in poverty, and a lot of people are suffering in working conditions that don't feel fair to them and are struggling. But you know what? A lot of the people who have found a good job in the Empire, they look at themselves and they go, yeah, I was in the same situation you were in. I was born in a working class family in a working on a working class planet, and I pulled myself out of that situation and I got a good job working for the Empire. And now I live on Coruscant and I've got like a dope apartment on Coruscant. And you can do the same thing, or you can sit on your garbage planet in your garbage little town and complain. And if you want to complain about the fact that, oh, I would have a better job if the Empire wasn't so greedy and if it didn't favor all of the top 1% of earners at the top, and if they didn't seem to be objectively evil, you know, you can complain about it. But what I did is I went and got a job. And what I see here is order and civility and the preservation of rules, you know, like we need rules in order to have a civilized society. So there's this great character on Andor. And I don't want to give away too much of the show, but there's this great character named Cyril Karn, who is a police officer, essentially, who works for the Empire. And his whole driving plot is that somebody killed two police officers and no one's doing anything about it. And he's driven to solve that and to figure out who did it and to bring them to justice. His plot is, on the surface, very just. This is a guy who has, we see his family, we see where he comes from, we see kind of, we get a peek into his psychology and what sort of drives him, but his overall motivation is that, like, a crime has taken place. Someone committed murder and no one's doing it. And not only murder, they killed two enforcers of the law. Now, we sort of see also who these guys are that got killed, and we kind of see that they seem kind of like scumbags and stuff like that. But that's not something that people ever consider when, like, a police officer gets killed in the line of duty. Whenever police officers get killed in the line of duty in our world, we don't go like, well, yeah, but were they kind of, like, what was their record? Did they do a lot of police brutality, or, like, were they kind of dirty? Did they ever accept bribes, or were they, did they, you know, commit domestic abuse? We just go like, that's awful. Someone who's out there in, doing a job where they are, you know, doing a public service, trying to preserve law and order, and someone killed them in the line of duty. That's awful. And so many people, and I don't think that that's necessarily a bad mindset to have. So this character has a very, you could say, pure intent with his motivation. But his entire worldview and ideology is based in the idea that the Empire is the linchpin holding civility in his galaxy together, for better or worse. Even if he can see problems with it, and he does, he's like, he doesn't like that his superiors aren't going to pursue these murder charges and look for this murderer. So he can see organizational or bureaucratic problems with it. At the crux of his ideology is, I believe that order is better than chaos, and what the rebellion represents and what people who are against the Empire represent is anarchy and chaos, and I don't want to live in that world. I want to live in a world where if I buckle down and get serious about my work, I can have a shot to have a good job and to make a good impact in the world. That's the world that Cyril Karn wants to live in. He's not just an evil guy who's been possessed by an evil man in a robe. That's not who he is, and that's not really who any of the villains of Andor are. They're all three-dimensional people who see themselves as servants of a system that maybe sometimes has to get its hands dirty to preserve order, but that's just what has to be done in order to keep the ball moving forward of civilized society in their galaxy. And I mean, God, this show's so good. It's so good. It's so good because it's Star Wars, and it has such a universal appeal, and so many people like Star Wars across the political spectrum. And what's so good about a show like Andor, and so important about a show like Andor, is there are undoubtedly going to be people watching this show who are back the blue people, who are people who have a Blue Lives Matter flag on their car, you know, with the thin blue line on the flag, people who absolutely believe that the police are a necessary force, and that when the police use force and when the police kill people, that most of the time it's justified, and that that's just the byproduct of having a dangerous job and enacting a dangerous service, a public service. There are going to be people who watch this show that's their ideology, and they're lifelong Star Wars fans, and they're not going to realize what this show is offering them. Or maybe they will, even. Maybe they'll even go like, oh shit, you know, you can sort of wind up tacitly supporting fascistic regimes just sort of by proxy, just by being like, I don't want to live in a world that's the opposite. I don't want to live in a world without them. I see them as the way to preserve the life that I have, and I don't know what my life is without them. And that's the first really brilliant thing about this show, is well-rounded villains who actually have realistic motivations for why they're doing what they're doing, who are supporting and enabling the rise of totalitarianism and of an evil ideology without necessarily knowing that that's what they're doing, and without really being aware of it. Like, they're just sort of bureaucrats who are getting caught up in just rules and a set way that things are supposed to be. The other way that fascistic regimes and totalitarian regimes, authoritarian regimes, whatever you want to call it, the other way that they rise to power is through the complacency of the populace, of the population, of people who either see that it's happening. We can see it happening, but you just feel sort of powerless. Like, well, what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to actually, in any meaningful way, stop that incredibly powerful organization from doing what they're doing? That's how it happens, is people who can see it happening, and also people who can see that there is a way where they could help, but aren't necessarily willing to engage with the cost of getting involved in the fight. This is one of my favorite things about this show, more so than the well-rounded villains and their motivations, which is just so amazing to see cinematically and just as a storyteller, but to actually see what the cost is of getting involved with and supporting a rebellion, to actually see what it costs someone and what it means to be the David in a David and Goliath situation and go, I'm going to actually make my life about opposing that encroaching evil, that force that is so big and so wealthy and so powerful, that is clearly moving toward a level of power that if they obtain it, we're all in huge trouble. I'm going to make my life about opposing that at all costs, even if that means making massive sacrifices. And I think most of us, myself included, I looked at this with this show and I thought, am I actually willing to do what it takes to oppose the threat of Trumpism? And I start thinking like, well, there's different ways that people can fight. And I definitely like to use my voice and my platform as my little rebellion and my way to push back and my way to call out what it is that I see them doing and to try to shine light on it. But at the end of the day, like, if push comes to shove and it looks like they are going to start taking over and they are going to start actually getting out loud about the real agenda and they are going to start, you know, coming for my gay and trans and non-binary friends, and they are going to start coming for Jewish people again, which it looks like that's the road that we're heading down right now. And if that starts happening again, would I be willing to actually put my life on the line and actually get involved at that level of, I'm now willing to sacrifice anything and everything to oppose this force? And I think that a lot of people, when it gets to that level, do get involved at that point where it's like, okay, well, now it's happening. Now my country is actually thrust into civil war where I no longer have the option of civil disobedience or of pushing back with just my voice or just a platform or just a spoken word or written word or a message. Now I actually have to get involved at the level of physical force. I think people do shift and go into that space, but like, before it gets to that point, would you be willing to do that? And that's, man, there are characters in this show who have made the choice that they are going to have to get physically involved with opposing the Empire because they see that the Empire is too powerful and is moving too quickly to just sort of try to deal with it politically or diplomatically. They see that, like, if they try a diplomatic approach where they just go out to different planets and try to recruit people to their grassroots cause and say, like, come on, let's try to build up a different political party that can oppose the Empire, it's not going to work. The Empire is moving too quickly. They are too wealthy. They are too powerful. Their reach has already extended too far. At this point, the only option is we have to actually start throwing haymakers, and we actually have to get our hands dirty. And that aspect of it, dude, is, it's sort of like stomach churning, because the vast majority of the people in the show who aren't involved in the Empire's cause, but who aren't necessarily involved in the rebellion either, they're people who can see that the society that they live in is fucked up and has problems. They can see that the Empire is kind of tyrannical and that the Empire is doing a lot of things that are like really unjust, and that the Empire is irresponsibly using its massive amount of power constantly and being very oppressive with its massive amount of power, but they just feel like, I'm just one small person, what am I supposed to do? And so they just sort of try to go about their quiet life and hope that it doesn't come for them, and hope that, and I think that happens. I think that that's happening right now in Hungary. I think that that happened in Germany in the 1940s. And I think it's absolutely happening right now in our country, that there, I mean, like I said, 81 million people for Biden, 75 million people for Trump, 350 million people in the country. About a third of our citizenry just goes like, whatever. Even if they can totally see the threat that is posed by Trumpism, even if they can clearly see the seeds of fascism being watered and grown, and they can see it germinating and happening before their very eyes, they're like, what, I'm going to go to the polling station and vote? I'm going to go vote, and that's going to change it? That's going to make people suddenly not believe that Trump is God and not pray to him and not, like, cult members all of a sudden, just because, no, they're just going to say that we cheated, and it's going to further divide the country, and it's going to just, we're, whatever I do, we're on a one-way road to civil war, and I'm just going to sort of try to enjoy my life till we get there. It's happening right now. And that's a huge part of Andor, is like characters that are just like, yeah, my life is hard, and yeah, I don't like the Empire, and I'm not a fan of them, but what do you want me to do? I'm just one person. I'm not actually going to make that big of a difference if I get involved. And you see, A, how these people can become radicalized and how they can become involved, but also B, like, what is the cost of not getting involved, and what is the cost of getting involved? And both have a cost. It's like, it's difficult. It's difficult work to actually decide that you're going to make your life more focused on actively opposing people who are trying to reenact the cycle that humanity has of giving rise to dangerous fascistic powers. It's happening right now. I said I don't want to do too many spoilers. I want you to watch this show if you haven't. You got to watch this show. It's incredible. If I haven't made a good enough endorsement of it, I want to read one speech from the show for you. If you don't want to hear it, that's totally fine. But Stellan Skarsgård plays a guy who is one of the original architects and leaders of the early rebellion. And at the end of one of the episodes, a spy that he has, he's got a spy that's working for him that's inside, deep inside of an imperial building. And this guy says, I don't think you appreciate how much I've sacrificed for you. Like, I'm constantly nervous. I live in constant fear that I'm going to be found out. And I don't think you appreciate how much I've sacrificed. And this guy asks him, what have you sacrificed? What have you given up? And this is just remember, this is in the Star Wars cinematic universe. This speech happens. A character says these words. I sat watching this episode and I was like, I cannot believe how good this writing is and how good the acting is as a result of such good writing. This is his answer when a character asks him, what have you sacrificed for this cause? He answers, calm, kindness, kinship, love. I've given up all chance at inner peace. I've made my mind a sunless space. I share my dreams with ghosts. I wake up every day to an equation I wrote 15 years ago from which there is only one conclusion. I'm damned for what I do. My anger, my ego, my unwillingness to yield, my eagerness to fight, they've set me on a path from which there is no escape. I yearned to be a savior against injustice without contemplating the cost, and by the time I looked down, there was no longer any ground beneath my feet. What is my sacrifice? I'm condemned to use the tools of my enemy to defeat them. I burn my decency for someone else's future. I burn my life to make a sunrise that I know I'll never see. And the ego that started this fight will never have a mirror or an audience or the light of gratitude. So what do I sacrifice? Everything. I mean, are you kidding me? Dude? Are you, like, I said at the beginning of this podcast that it's the best piece of content ever created in the Star Wars universe, and it is. But, like, that's one of the best monologues I've ever heard, period, in anything. Someone in a story about a rebellion, a small underfunded, under-equipped rebellion, opposing a massive fascistic imperial force. Someone asks someone else, what have you sacrificed for this cause? And that's their response. Literally everything. My decency. I have to use the tools of my enemy to defeat them. I have to engage in the same violence that they use in order to fight back against. I've had to literally snuff out the decency of my soul and give my, like, I have, like, my ego that won't allow me to sit back and tacitly watch this happen doesn't even get the benefit of getting to, like, see the results of my labor. Like, I'm going to die for this cause before I see it pay off. Just stunning. Beautiful, haunting writing. Okay, so I went longer than I told everyone I was gonna go. I'm like an hour and 10 minutes into this thing. Watch Andor and contemplate, how does fascism rise? How does it take root? Does anyone have any questions in the chat? People have been writing things in the chat. I've been blabbing. Do you have any comments? Did you watch Andor? Have you not watched Andor? Are you interested in watching Andor? Do you have thoughts? Do you have fan theories? Do you have thoughts on how fascism gives rise? Ryman805 on TikTok says, do you have a podcast? I sure do. That's what I'm doing right now. It's called People Pleaser with Austin Archer, and you're listening to it right now, currently. You are on it, Ryman805. You're on the podcast. Do you have any thoughts on how we can oppose the fascistic forces that are germinating and rising in our country right now? Is there a way to get involved in the fight without getting your hands dirty? Is there a way to stay diplomatic at this stage? I want to believe that there is. I want to believe that, like, words and ideas can be enough, and that we don't need to come to fisticuffs and to blows, and that we don't need to stoop to the level of using our enemy's tools to defeat them. What are your thoughts? Nicole Hall on YouTube says, I wasn't interested until I heard this stream. Yeah, it's not enough people are watching the show. That's the other reason why I wanted to talk about it, is nobody's talking about it. Like, I go out to lunch with friends and everyone's talking about what TV shows they're watching, and there's a lot of good TV on right now. And I get it. Nobody's watching Andor, and I get it because most of the Disney Plus shows, Star Wars or not, have been bad. I've said this on the podcast before. Disney's bad. They're bad at making stuff. That's why Andor is also frustrating, is like, I wish Andor was like on HBO or something, or somewhere where people would take it more seriously. It's crazy that Disney Plus has anything to do with the production of a show as good as Andor is, but I really give them, like, no credit other than credit for, like, letting Tony Gilroy and his team do their thing. That's the only credit I give them. But what's frustrating is that, like, they're not going to be inclined to make more shows like it if nobody watches it. If everybody watches Obi-Wan and Boba Fett and The Mandalorian, but nobody watches Andor, they're just going to make more Boba Fett and more shows like Obi-Wan and The Mandalorian, and they're not going to make more shows like Andor. But if we show them that, like, that's what we want, is high-quality storytelling, high-quality writing, high-quality cinematography, and actually well-rounded characters, they'll make more shows like that. But, yeah, Disney's bad. They make so much content every year when it comes to TV shows, movies, everything. They're, when it comes to the Disney Channel, all this stuff, and like 98% of it is just garbage. And they have like two or three hits a year between the movies that they put out and all the TV shows that they put out. But Andor is definitely the best thing that Disney Plus has put out, like, by a wide margin, not even close. And it's probably the best thing in the Star Wars canon as well. And I want more people to watch it, because it, even if you're not a Star Wars fan, it's just good. It's just good writing. It's just, good stuff. Nizuya says, unfortunately, Andor had a slow start. I know several people who bailed. Episode 4 plus are great though. Yeah, man, stuff bums me out so much like that. Like, that people, I saw some YouTubers who are like big Star Wars fans talking about that they were like, I don't get it. It's boring. And I'm like, yeah. So, like, there are going to be people who, like, what they want from Star Wars is The Mandalorian. They want a big action sequence at least once an episode that's really cool and has like a lot of like really cool moments. And hey, that's a fair expectation. Star Wars as a brand has been built on like cool. Like lightsabers are just cool. They're not the most practical weapon that you could fight with, but they're cool. And having like a lightsaber fight and having a lightsaber duel between like two, you know, space wizards who are expert martial artists is cool. So the expectation when you sit down to watch a Star Wars property that there's going to be lots of like explosions and lasers and cool stuff to hold your attention is warranted. I get it. But also I'm like, man, I wish that you would also have a temperament for your favorite thing doing something a little bit different, but that is like leagues ahead of everything else when it comes to storytelling. And some of the best TV shows ever made start slow. Like Better Call Saul right now, everyone's talking about how like it might be better than Breaking Bad. Everyone agrees that Breaking Bad is like the best show ever. And I haven't even watched Better Call Saul, but everyone I talk to who's watched it is like, it might be better than Breaking Bad. And the reason why I got stalled on Better Call Saul is like, it takes a minute to get into it. But a lot of great TV shows are that way, where you need to like, what you should be looking for, I think, in the first few episodes of a TV show isn't like, was the first episode awesome with an amazing cliffhanger that you had to watch the next episode and it was action-packed. It's just like, is this competently put together? What does it look like? Like, is the cinematography good? Is the writing good? Is the acting good? Is this well made? And if it's well made, if it's well constructed, you can trust those filmmakers like to go on that journey. And that's what I saw with the first few episodes of Andor was like, well, this is much the production quality here from a writing standpoint, from an acting standpoint, from a cinematography standpoint is leagues ahead of all of the other Star Wars shows on Disney Plus. The production quality is better. So yeah, it didn't get off to an amazing start with a sitting on the edge of your seat cliffhanger at the end of the first episode. But like, I wish we didn't need every single show to have that amazing nail-biting cliffhanger at the end of the first episode to get us to keep watching. I wish that it was enough just to like have competent filmmaking on display. Unpopular opinion, says Shane, deconstructs on TikTok. Best show ever is Haunting of Hill House. Great show. Great show. Great filmmaker. I like that guy a lot. I recently watched Dr. Sleep for the first time, and I liked it so much. I think that he's great. What's his name? Michael Flannery? Michael Flanagan. Good director, and Haunting of Hill House was great. Was fantastic. I really, really loved it. I don't know if I'd call it the best TV show ever, but it was fantastic. Really, really entertaining, and also just like solid acting, solid writing, solid direction. Mike Flanagan does a really, really good job with properties like that. Refrigerate After Opening on YouTube says, another great example of how fascism takes hold is The Wave. True story, but of course the movie has some traumatization. I've seen that. We watched that in high school, and it's a movie, at least the movie that I watched, was about a high school that's doing a totalitarian experiment where they're simulating a totalitarian society, and in that simulation, it gets out of control, and the people with power start liking it too much. And like, we actually did that. I had a class in high school called American Problems, where we simulated different kinds of world governments, and we did a totalitarian simulation. And I was the chairman, which was the leader, and it was fun. In that it was a dramatization of something that was like really over the top, and it was like a fun character for me to play, but it was also like kind of scary. There was an image of my eyes blown up on the wall, and when I wasn't in the classroom, everyone had to keep their eyes on my eyes, and I had state police that would watch people and make sure that they were watching my eyes. And then when I would come back into the classroom, everyone had to stand up and salute me. When I would walk through the halls at school, the people who were part of my state had to salute me when they saw me. And I got so wrapped up in playing the character that I was, for the 2 weeks that we did the simulation, I was an asshole to my classmates and to my friends. And people afterward, we did a postmortem afterward and did feedback, and everyone got to say like what their experience was like. And my experience being the leader of the state was, like I said, it was fun. I had fun. I got off on it. I was having so much fun being the center point of this whole experiment, that everything like revolved around me. I got to give a huge speech in the auditorium to my state and march them around the school, and every, you know, like I commanded respect everywhere I went. But listening to my classmates talk about their experience, it was like, I thought everyone was having fun like I was playing along and being part of the simulation. Everyone was really mad at me at the end of it. People were like, you were so rude to me for the last 2 weeks, and I know that you were just playing a role, but like, I think you took it too far, and I think that like, you owe me an apology. Like, several people were like, I didn't like the way that you treated me for the last 2 weeks. It wasn't fun. My friends told me, they were like, yeah, man, you went too far with it. Like, you were never out of character, and like you, and I wasn't. I was in for the 2 weeks and I was having a blast. But you even see that, how like power becomes an intoxicant and it can blind you to the harm that you're causing. And it was just this stupid little dramatization, this little experiment that we did in school. But like, it really showed sort of how in my mind I was just playing this game. And I think that that's how Donald Trump sees it. I think Trump sees it as a game. I think he sees the entire political landscape as like this game that you either play the game or you get fallen in the dust into irrelevancy. And irrelevancy is not an option for someone with his public visibility. Like, his livelihood and his entire life is built around being relevant and being in the conversation and being and having a meaningful impact. And the way that he plays the game is by being is through fascistic tools and means and being a dictator. But I think he's convinced himself that like, there's nothing inherently wrong with what he's doing, because he's just playing the game that as it was presented to him. Ryman805 asks, are other Republicans playing the game? Of course. Yeah, absolutely. Again, Andor, it shows how people aren't doing what they're doing because they're just evil. Maybe Emperor Palpatine is doing what he's doing because he's evil. The Star Wars cinematic universe has a lot of just kind of evil people who are just evil for the sake of being evil. But both Rogue One and Andor have bad characters who are playing the game. Ben Mendelsohn's character in Rogue One, fantastic villain, is a guy who is playing a political game. He has this power struggle between him and Tarkin, and it's just this like, it's this, he's not doing it because he's evil. He's doing it because that's the position he finds himself in. And he either continues to climb that ladder and continues to play that game, or he dies. If he backs out, if he tries to get out of his duties at the level that he's at, Darth Vader is going to fucking kill him. So like, yeah, there's absolutely people who are saying reprehensible things in our political landscape, in the Republican Party, on the American conservative right, who are doing reprehensible things, saying reprehensible things, who aren't, if in their minds, evil people or bad people. They are just playing the role. You see this all the time with Republicans who like are clearly going against something they said 6 months earlier. That like 6 months earlier on the news, they said one thing, and then 6 months later, when the party shifted its messaging to another thing, they say the polar opposite. And it's like, well, what, do you not have any dignity? Do you not have any conviction with your ideals? And it's not that, it's just, they're just playing the game as they see that the game is meant to be played. And when people question them, like, how can you flip flop like that? How can you be such a hypocrite? I think in their brains, they're like, what do you mean? You just don't understand how the game is played. Like, you're just ignorant of the fact that I'm doing what I need to do to survive politically, to keep my job, to keep my relevance, to stay involved in the machine. So it's not necessarily that I'm just evil. It's that I find myself in the situation I'm in. I have a high-ranking position with this particular political ideology, and this is what I need to do to stay relevant there and to survive and to provide for my family. Cerber the Barbarian asks, can I enjoy Andor with minimal Star Wars knowledge? Yes, you can. And I don't think that that's true of any of the other Star Wars shows. I don't think that you would enjoy The Mandalorian with minimal Star Wars knowledge. I don't think that you would enjoy Obi-Wan. Like, the only reason I enjoy Obi-Wan and The Mandalorian at all is because I'm a Star Wars fan. I thought Boba Fett was hot garbage. I didn't enjoy it at all. But the only reason I enjoy Mandalorian and Obi-Wan at all is because I'm such a Star Wars fan, and I'm just excited to like see more things in that universe, even though I know that they're not like the most high caliber quality. Andor, you can actually, like, just like how you can enjoy Game of Thrones without being like a huge fantasy nerd. Like, you don't have to be a person who grew up loving Dungeons and Dragons and loving all things fantasy and Lord of the Rings and all that stuff to enjoy Game of Thrones, because Game of Thrones isn't just about pandering to fans of dragons and fantasy realms. It's about the mechanics of socio-political struggle. Like, it's about the way that, like, people seek and gain and lose power. And there are many parallels to our own world. So when you're watching Game of Thrones, you can literally see how the writing and the characters and the dimensionality to it pertains to our actual world. And you can have that exact same experience watching Andor. You don't need to know anything about Star Wars other than that, like, the central conceit to Star Wars is there is this powerful imperial force called the Empire that runs the galaxy, and there is a rebellion fighting against them. And that's it. And this show is about the birth of that rebellion and the way that a rebellion fights against a force like that and the cost of that. And also about, like, how does the Empire get to that place in the first place? How are they so big and powerful? How do they proliferate their power? You can absolutely enjoy it without knowing anything about Star Wars. Hey Austin asks free champagne. Hey Austin, any words for our cool voters in Georgia? Absolutely. Bah, 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 bah. Go voters in Georgia. And you know what? Thank you, Herschel Walker, for conceding and for not saying that it was definitely stolen and that cheating happened. Props and kudos to Herschel Walker and the Herschel Walker campaign for conceding gracefully. Like, that, you know, that's crazy that we're at a place in our politics where we have to, like, congratulate people for doing the bare minimum, which is just like conceding an election when you lose an election, you know, which is more than we can say for, you know, Carrie Lake and her team who said that they were going to claim fraud before the election happened. And here they are claiming fraud, just like they said they were going to. Austin, you should YouTube How Liberty Dies, The Politics of Star Wars. It's long, though. I have watched that and it's fantastic. And other people should watch it too after they watch Andor. Let's see here. Let's see if there's one more comment we can get to, and then we'll call the show. Oh, geez. It's X-Core on TikTok just said, first time Walker successfully pulled out of something. Oh, boy. That comment is fantastic. Congratulations to you for writing that comment. That was excellent. B-Queen on TikTok asks, we'll end it with this. How do we fight back against these people with so much power, money, control, and no morals? That is the question. That's sort of the central question of this episode, is how do we? And what does that look like? What form does your personal rebellion take? Does the size of the power that you're fighting kind of bully you into complacency? Do you just kind of go like, it's too big? It's too big for me to even conceive of trying to fight it, so why bother? That happens a lot. I don't know that I actually have an answer for that question. I know that the way that I'm fighting back right now is by doing stuff like this, just trying to my best to disseminate good ideas and good information and good arguments, and to pull for marginalized communities in all things, to always pull and err on the side of pulling for marginalized communities over communities that hold disproportionate power over them, to call out injustice anywhere you see it. But is that going to be enough in a world that so commonly these things get resolved with physical force? Will diplomatic means be enough? And I genuinely don't know. I always want to believe that we are evolving into a society that can and should be able to resolve our differences through diplomatic means and through just the exchange of ideas and through the exchange of information. But I genuinely don't know. I hope, and I'm going to continue fighting in that way until it looks like that's not a viable option anymore. And all I would say is I encourage anyone out there within the reach of my voice to get involved, you know, in whatever way you can, in whatever way you have availability for. You know, try to have these conversations with your friends and family, and try to, you know, get curious about things that you haven't been curious about before. And watch Andor. It's great. Hey, everybody, thank you for your comments, and thanks for bearing with me on this episode and letting me be a nerd for a while and nerd out about. I'm just so happy that there's a Star Wars property that is so good. I'm just so happy that, like, the thing that I've loved since I was a kid is no longer a thing that I have to sort of like sheepishly admit that I like, but I will be less embarrassed by it the more people that watch it, so that more people can see it and know that it's not just some dorky thing that I'm watching, but that it's actually like one of the best TV shows this year and one of the best TV shows in years. Anyway, thanks for being here. I appreciate it. Thanks for hanging out on TikTok. Thanks for hanging out in the chat on YouTube. Really appreciate y'all. Love y'all. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or by going to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com and buying it there, dude. Patreon.com/austinarcher if you want to support this show and the content that I make. Shout out to the Patreon patrons. We love you so much. Hey, it's the holidays, so Cameo. I'm on Cameo. If you're looking for something fun to get for your loved one who you know is a big fan of your pal Austin, that's an easy thing. Get him a Cameo. I'll say hi. I'll say, hey, what's up? How you doing? Merry Christmas. You can find that at the links in my bios on all of my things, my Cameo, if you want to do one of those. I think that's about it. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next week. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Love ya. Bye-bye. I got a great self-esteem. But oh, my, seems like the more I know, the less I know.